Hello, I'm Steven.
And I'm Marshall.
And welcome to Emissaries of Profits by Androids and Assets, the bi-weekly show where we discuss the political economy of the Federation Outpost in the Bajoran sector of the Alpha Quadrant. That is, in other words, how decisions get made, how opportunities are distributed, conflicts resolved, and who gets screwed over. Spoilers. It's usually the Bajorans. That's right, we're talking about Deep Space Nine every episode in varying levels of detail. And boy, Marshall, I'm excited. We're doing Destiny, which aired February 13th, 1995. Profit Motive, February 20th, 1995. So we're halfway through the decade. We're halfway through the 90s. So feels good.
We are making it.
1995 being a notable year, obviously. Although late in 2024... when Mr. O.J. Simpson was arraigned, he actually goes to trial on January 24th, 1995. So a few weeks before this. For our listeners who were not born yet or were too young to really be cognizant, it is extremely difficult to overstate how pervasive the discourse about this trial was. It really was the televisual event of the decade, and it represents the high watermark of corruption and racism in American life. But the episode we're talking about was written prior to the trial, probably not prior to Nicole Brown's death, but yeah, anyway, I don't think it's a factor in these episodes, but I felt I'm already remiss for not doing this in the last episode, because it is, if you were alive in this space, it just, I mean, I was very young and I was extremely, I knew in a shocking level of detail, what was going on with the O.J. Simpson affair. So, do you remember this, Marshall?
Not as well as you do, but I do remember the Naked Gun movies had O.J. Simpson in them.
Yes. Yeah, he's quite a big celebrity.
Yeah. And I think they made jokes about it.
Ooh.
Or something. I'm not sure. I can't remember entirely, but I remember OJ being in it and being like, wait, how is he in this movie? I was too young to have a really good sense of temporality.
Yeah. For those who don't know, OJ Simpson was a football player for the Bills of the city of Buffalo, New York. And he also was a fairly successful film and television actor following his NFL career. He's been accused of murder of his wife, Nicole Brown, in 1994. Okay, I don't think we need to talk about this anymore. We got some...
If the glove don't fit.
You must acquit. That hasn't happened yet. I'm reading a lot about the O.J. Simpson trial because I want to give people a good blow-by-blow.
Yeah.
Rob, I mean, yeah, this is, it's going to be, I mean, it kind of births the whole, like, Rob Kardashian, Kim Kardashian's father, is very involved in this. Our good friend Alan Dershowitz is very prominent in this. It's just a weird gallery of ghouls, but we'll talk more as this progresses.
Marshall, kicks off some major legal careers here.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and creates the celebrity trial media circus in a way that had not happened before and in many ways has not happened since.
Destiny is an episode that aired on February 13th, 1995, in case you forgot that in the minutes previous. We're trying to get permanent communications through the wormhole. We want to be able to talk to the Gamma Quadrant all the time. Right now, it's sort of like when the wormhole is open, I think they can do some communication through it. Or they like fly a ship through and send a message.
Yeah, and I think it's also for like you want. Wild. Yeah, and I think it's also for having like it's more for having an installation on the other side. So when people are sending messages, if the wormhole's not open, those messages bounce. But the subspace relay can collect them over there, and then when the wormhole opens, beam all of the communication from when the wormhole was closed back.
Oh, I think it beams it even while the wormhole is closed.
Well, it does, but that's not its design.
That's the hope, at least.
No. Because they can only work from
this.
Yeah. So it's more to have something that collects and distributes data and signal there. Now it becomes that way, but we'll get into that.
Okay. I thought that was the permanent goal all along. Anyway, to help them achieve this goal, they have invited some Cardassian scientists who suspect that they have a method that will allow for this communication, and they have a good relay design, and they have new techniques that are going to allow communications through the wormhole without a complete and utter breakdown of the data stream. And so this is like a test sort of the new peace treaty.
Sure, I guess.
And so it's a very exciting time.
Tripartite diplomacy.
Yeah. So they're being invited over, which, given everything, this is like a very optimistic decision, you know, both on the behavior of the Cardassians and also on like the behavior of the Dominion on the other side of the wormhole. You're like, if we just leave a relay out here, no one's going to touch it, right? It's going to be fine. No one will blow that thing up. The thing that is entirely detectable.
It is a massive provocation. It is a massive provocation to the Dominion. The Dominion is very clear. You stay on your side, we'll stay on ours. You go and you put an installation in there.
I mean, like, it's a light act of war.
A light act of war. I mean, yeah. I mean, we live in a world where our countries routinely commit light acts of war all the time. So.
Yes, that's true. And so the Cardassians were preparing for their arrival. We're in some rooms looking at them, and Odo is prepared to give these Cardassians the best possible treatment. The temperature has been raised in the rooms. The relative humidity is higher. He's got guards stationed on the doors at all times, and somebody who will trail them around the station everywhere they go, so they'll never be alone.
What is this, North Korea?
Quark interrupts the senior staff, who, for some reason, most of the senior staff are in this room, being like, wow, it's warm in here. Good. As if they've never experienced temperature control in their lives. And this is the first time. Huh. We can do that. And Quark comes in and interrupts. Odo's like, how do you even know that there's Cardassians coming? And he just like taps his nose. He's like, haha, I know things. Dax is surprised at Quark being excited about this Cardassians coming back and that he's going to give them gifts and things. But then he explains that he's just happy that he's able to now finally sell off the remainder of his Cardassian foodstuffs. They've just been there for so long. And he's like, I can finally get rid of these. Dax understands his excitement. And she quotes, she says, I think it's the 34th rule of acquisition. Peace is good for business. Quark understands and corrects her and says, no, you're thinking of the 35th rule of acquisition. The 34th rule is war is good for business.
What?
the jokes of the writers of like, the 34th and the 35th, they're the same. They're very easy to get confused. So we're back in Ben's office, and a Vedic comes to him with a dire warning, and Kira escorts this Vedic in, and he says, if you allow the Cardassians on the station, everything will be destroyed. Fade to black. It's a commercial break. Vedic Yarka has interpreted an old Bajoran prophecy. He believes the signs are coming true and that the Cardassians are a sign that the wormhole is about to be destroyed. He gives some evidence, and it all feels like a real stretch of like, there's a river that moved. Yeah, and there's like three vipers, and I think Cardassians are vipers, which is a real racist thing for me to say, but I grew up under the occupation, so it was a different time. And Ben is sort of like, yeah, does the Vedic Assembly know about this? And Vedic Yarka is like, yes, of course they do, but they chose to ignore me, those fools, because he's right, and everyone else is wrong about everything. That's how prophecy works. Meanwhile, two Cardassian women arrive on the station. They are prepared to do their science stuff. They meet with the DS9 senior staff, and they discuss a plan to get a permanent communication network. Like, we can do this. They're going to do some future science-y stuff. They're going to use solitons as a stabilizer for a communication relay. It's going to blow your mind. Miles recognizes this and he's like, we tried that already. And this is like the beginning of the B plot. Because Galora, one of the Cardassians, is like, oh, you don't you worry your pretty little head about it. We've solved this problem. You guys just weren't good enough at it. You weren't precise enough with your science. And he's like, we were within 0.1 deviation. She's like, yeah, and that's a really small number, but it's still too big a number. Like, I know that it's hard for you to understand, but it's fine. Don't worry.
It's a real asshole.
He gets frustrated. She doesn't even notice. They go back to their rooms to unpack or whatever Cardassians do when they're on a hostile station. And Ben jokes and he says, well, there's only two Cardassians, so only two Vipers. Ha ha ha. And of course, one of them turns around. Yeah, three Vipers in the prophecy. One of them turns around and is like, oh, by the way, we have a friend. She's going to be here later today. So there you go. And Kira turns and is like,
three
I'm
Vipers.
Super religious. I fall for the prophecy. Immediately after that, she just is like, this prophecy must 100% be true because there was a weird coincidence. I don't know. She's really into astronomy. Astrology? Both.
Something. I mean, she lives in space, so astronomy is presumably pretty important to that.
Yeah, she's a fan of both of them. And later, Vedic Yarka confronts Kira on the station, like on the promenade, and he's like, you know, faith is super important, and you should never do anything in your life without consulting your religion first. And she's like, you know, that's a good thought. I will think about that and take it to heart, Vedic. You are a good dude. And he's trying to convince her to get Ben to stop the project.
He is the emissary. You know,
that's his end goal here.
For those who don't remember.
Ben has that power. So they continue with the science. They're ready. They take the Defiant into the Gamma Quadrant. They're going to drop off a relay there. Once they arrive, they're just about ready to set it off. And then they do some like last minute scan. And they're like, oh gosh, hey, look, there's a comet out here. And the comet has a tail.
Makes it very
as
shiny.
As comets often do. It was a shiny tail. And Kira looks at it and is like, that's part of the prophecy. Because there was something about a sword.
Sword
so she's like, that's it! That's the sword!
Sword of stars.
And everything is all held together by this cryptic phrase that, you know, if you just convince yourself that that cryptic phrase is true, you will find a way to make it true. She's very good at that. And Ben gets annoyed and is like, you! Into a private room. And they have a conversation about, like, religion and science. And he's like, look, you can believe what you want to believe, but science is the thing that we base our actions on. And she's like, yeah, but I think you're a religious guy and you're an icon in my faith. So I can never treat you the same way again after this. You're kind of my Messiah.
Normal thing to say to your boss. Yeah. Yeah. You are the Messiah of my religion. I look forward to working with you.
I hope this doesn't tinge our interactions in the future. Cardassians are like, let's get going with these tests, folks. We got problems to solve here. They send the first test and it fails. The Cardassian does some adjustments and they do a second test and immediately the wormhole reacts and is like, it's got some problems and it sends off some gravitons. Yeah. It becomes somehow much more dense briefly.
More gravitous.
Gravity. Yeah. And that comet that was going to fly by completely harmlessly is now heading directly at the wormhole and will most assuredly destroy it.
And turns out that thing that
it's
makes
part
it so
of the
sparkly.
Prophecy.
Yeah, the stuff that the comet's made of that makes it so shiny and that makes you have that nice tail is wormhole poison.
Yeah.
If it gets in the wormhole, it's done.
We're going to have to do something about this. And they think what we should do is shoot it with our gun. We can blow up this comet. No problem, folks. We can blow it up. But something goes wrong. They make some phaser adjustments. The phaser adjustment like blows up, and instead of doing a wide range phaser, they do a short, narrow phaser.
Yeah, they
and
don't.
Instead of destroying the whole thing, they just break it into three parts,
three big chunks that they can't do anything about.
Yeah,
and it's like a first year like dummy mistake. O'Brien can't believe he made it. But one thing, like, how did this happen? On. Oh my god.
Yeah. So they go back to Deep Space Nine and they're working the problem. Everyone's coming up with solutions and they're like, well, you know, here's the thing we could try. And the Cardassians, the two good Cardassians, because there's the three Cardassians. One of them is like, I love Cardassian food. I love Cardassia. And the other two are like, I'd like to try other food. Cardassia is cool, but like other people are also cool. No, shut up, Cardassia. So the two good Cardassians are like, in case you couldn't tell, she's an Obsidian Order agent and is here to sabotage everything. So maybe lock her up. And Ben says, good idea. You're confined to your quarters. And she's like, I'll get you for this, my pretties.
And I would have got away with it, too, if it weren't for those meddling Cardassian scientists.
And then they say, what if we just put a space lasso around those three pieces and guided them through the wormhole safely?
Yeah, we'll use the and subspace says, field from a shuttle, and we'll shepherd the comet debris safely through.
That's what I said. Space lasso from a Toyota Corolla. And Ben, who is the sheriff out in the Wild West, says, I am better at lassoing things than any of you. I'll do the lassoing. And Kira says, I'm coming with you. And he just sort of is like, oh God, of course. Pressure. So they fly back. He gets in a Corolla, lassos the three. They leave the Defiant on the other side in case they need to do something drastic at the last minute to save Deep Space Nine from completely blowing up. And then you see Kira and Ben as they like are guiding these things through the wormhole. But by using their engines on the Corolla, it's destabilizing things even more. So Ben's we're going to have to do this without engines.
A little bit of comet leaks through, starts leaking through the subspace.
Yeah, there's leaking comet.
Yeah.
And it gets worse because if they have their engines on, they disrupt the space lasso. So they have to turn their engines off. And he says, inertia is going to have to carry us the rest of the way. Which,
sure.
Yeah, it will. You're in space, dude. Unless you decelerate, like, and put action going the other direction, your ship won't coast to a stop for a very long time.
Longer
we're
than
talking
your
like close
life.
To eternity.
Yeah.
Like, odds are it'll either collide with something else or it'll get caught in an orbit and just go forever. It's space. That's what happens. Anyway, also, even if their ship wasn't going to keep going, they have this huge-ass comet that they're lassoed onto. It's not going to stop anytime. Like, they don't need the engines to move it. Whatever. They make it all the way through the wormhole. And the stuff that was leaking from the comet, turns out that they leaked just enough of the stuff, just the right amount of the sauce, that now communication like when you send a communication through the wormhole, it can follow that stuff and make it all the way through the wormhole. So they've like stabilized the wormhole,
but they've left it. It's all the wormhole now always stays open a little bit, and they can always snake a little signal through it. And this is important because this is in the prophecy, because it says that and the temples. The temple's doors will be broken, which people take to mean that like the wormhole will go away forever. But so.
Yeah. And so then Kira is like, oh, my God, I had it wrong the whole time. Actually, OK. Listen, hear me out. The three Vipers were actually the comets because there's three of them. And the Sword of Stars was the bits from the comet. And then, like, you're here too, Emissary. So, like, if you think about it, actually, this was the prophecy. And it was a good thing. Whoa. Solved it. Because that's obviously what they were going to do. No matter what happened, they were going to solve the prophecy. Uh, Yarka then comes over to Ben and is like, I'm really sorry about the fright that I caused. I didn't mean to. But did you know there's a fourth prophecy? And I have some evidence that it's coming true very soon. And Ben humors him. He's like, why don't you tell me about it? It made me think of the rationalists from Parks and Rec. The world's going to end on this night, so we need to book the park. And everyone's like, okay, yeah, we'll have a party in the park. And then the world doesn't end, and they come back the next day like, you know, actually, I checked my notes, and it's not going to end until April 24th. Yeah, the park's free that day. Yeah, it's April 24th. That's for sure when it's going to end. That's Ben. He's like, sure, the world's going to end, of course.
Humoring,
yeah,
he's humoring right. A weird cult.
Yeah. The B plot of this whole thing is that all of the adjustments in the science that they're doing, it's Galora and Miles are doing this together. So they're in Jeffrey's tubes, or they're in Cardassian tunnels through Deep Space Nine. And Galora sees some of the work that he's done, and she's sort of like horrified, amazed, because she's like, what have you done here? He's like, well, Starfleet regulations is that we have to have a secondary backup. We have to have like the primary, the secondary, and a backup. And she's like, the odds of that happening, of you ever needing that, are so low. And he's like, yeah, but I'd hate for that to have happen. Right? And they're kind of like, they're going back and forth. He's trying to convince her to be more safe. She's trying to be like, it's fine. We can be like wildly irresponsible with these things, which then makes me wonder, when it comes to the Solitons being within like 0.1, how are they more accurate than Starfleet when the whole time they're just like, we don't care?
We learned some crazy things about Cardassian engineering norms, because when yes. when the Solitons make gravity in the wormhole or whatever, they're like, why didn't you tell us about this? Oh, there was only a 2% chance of that happening. Well, within what we consider safe. And I'm like, whoa, you consider something happening one every 50 times, like, acceptable?
Yeah. That is, I mean, I haven't looked up safety standards on things.
Wild.
But way lower than that.
Yeah. If you
could you imagine, like, car seat safety? Yeah. 2% of the time, the car seat fails completely.
Yeah.
Should be fine,
it's
right?
Fine.
No. Not fine at all. That car seat will never get produced.
Yeah. The strap.
And should
the strap,
never get produced.
One in every 50 times, it just goes through confetti. It's fine.
It's fine. One in 50 times when you turn this barbecue on, it's going to explode.
It will kill you.
Do you have a different barbecue?
Now, I will say that this there are regulatory frameworks that are bad. And
well, yes.
Like Canada recently raised its allowable limit of what's essentially Roundup. I don't know the scientific name, but allowing its content in food to go up 5 times, which is not okay, given the fact that Roundup is a proven carcinogen. But, you can't have a bad regulatory framework.
Yes, and we regularly do. And most often, it's when it's a something that's out of the public eye.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Barbecues and car seats, we have good regulatory frameworks because we would hear about that.
Yeah.
Right away. Yeah.
Whereas a few thousand people get cancer over them. Whereas a few 10,000 people get cancer over the next 25 years. We don't hear about that.
Hidden casualties. Mm-hmm. Yeah, hidden casualties are a terrible, terrible thing that happen. Anyway, Miles and Galora. Miles keeps trying to convince Galora to let him help. She's like, I'm doing science things. Leave me alone. Why don't you go get me some tea or something? And he's like, bitch, fine, whatever. and then he's angry about it. And then eventually she's like, you know, we could have sex. I do like you. And you're better at this engineering stuff than most men. And he's like, what? Pardon me? And she's like, yeah, like I'm super sexist. Because men just don't have the brain for engineering. You guys aren't science brains.
They just don't. They're just, they lack the chromosome. But you're clearly into me.
I've seen the way you've been treating me, like complete and utter garbage. I know you obviously want to have children. You're like, you guys have some real weird societal norms and really need to work on this. Because Miles is a very kind person. So,
I mean, we do kind of live in a society where, like, being a huge asshole is a way that you can tell someone that you are interested in them. This is awful.
True. Hey, fellas, don't do that.
Be nice to people.
You know, saying like, oh, he's teasing you because he likes you. He's pulling your hair because he likes you. That's not cool. That's not okay. You should tell people that if you like someone, treat them nicely. Be kind to them.
And communicate. Take all your ridiculous, insane, psychobabble, pickup artist bullshit and shove it in the trash.
Burn it,
yeah, and just be honest and direct, kind and considerate. You'll do much better, I promise.
Yeah.
Regardless of what your goal is. Regardless, that will also get you sex. That will get you
unless you just want to be mean to people. Yeah.
Unless you just want to be mean, I guess then it doesn't give you what you want. Unless you're a real monster, in which case you should never have what you want. Fuck you.
I don't want to have sex with anybody. I just want to pull her hair. Okay, well, I mean, please still don't. But Miles is very confused and he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. No, you were being mean to me. I was being mean to you. I thought this was just meanness. I have a wife and a child and I'm very happy the way that I am. I'm not attracted to you in any way whatsoever. And immediately after he says that, he's like, oh God, that came out wrong too. Look, you're a beautiful lady. And I'm sure somebody's very lucky to have you, but it's not me. It's not me. I'm so sorry. I'm a kind guy. I'm trying to be nice to you.
He's bad. He's bad at letting people down.
Oh, I see. You're an engineer.
Maybe the greatest engineer
of all time.
But that's also the Cardassian that rats on the Obsidian Order agent, right?
Yes.
It's,
yeah.
It's so because of the bond.
Right. Now they're friends, and so she's like, Obsidian Order. And then at the end of the episode, Miles and her, he's escorting her off of the station. He's like, hey, you know what? That was a really cool thing you did. That was like, I hope you're going to be okay when you go back to Cardassia. Like, you really put your neck out there for us. Starfleet. Wild. And she's like, yeah, it'll be fine. The Obsidian Order is probably going to kill her, though.
Yeah. I'm sure the bureaucracy of science will shelter her from the incredibly murderous deep state in Cardassia.
That's exactly what she says, though. She says, my superiors at the Ministry of Science will
protect me.
Because the Ministry of Science reports to the army. And so I guess there's some legate who's like the science legate, like no, you can't hurt her. Shut up, science legate.
I mean, as with the way that the Pentagon functions, I'm sure this person's like a real raw army guy, and he just happens to be in charge of the science. Like, well, I don't know a lot about all that, but
look, I just have one question. Is it going to kill people? You got the funding.
Granted, also many of these people are also highly educated, but I don't know, you know?
Yeah, it's fine. Okay, this summary took way longer than it should have, and I apologize for that. But also, it's a convoluted episode. And And it feels like if you take out any one section of it, the rest of the episode just makes zero sense. You're like, okay, I just won't talk about the comet. You can't not talk about the comet. The comet's essential.
You can't not talk about Galora slagging off Miles. Like, you just can't.
Yeah.
Because that's like, really critical to the resolution of the episode. Yeah.
So, and I think this ties into what I sort of saw of this, like the theme in this, because the whole time I was like, this is like a conspiracy theory. Like, there's some obscure writing that somebody uncovered, and then they're like, that applies to the modern day. And if you just think about it in this way, and if you call those three women serpents and you call that comet a sword, then you see we're all going to die. And if you miss any one part of a conspiracy theory, like if you're following along with Q and then you stop following QAnon for like a day, the next news stories just make no sense. Like, sorry, what? There's a pizza parlor somewhere? Why?
Pizzagate precedes QAnon.
Yeah, but none of it made any sense.
Well, it doesn't make any sense if you pay attention to it either. But yes, I hear what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. On this point, I mean, I think it's really interesting as you have this, you have like a fringe theological tradition. Right. I think that is very salient when you consider QAnon, just because QAnon exists in the civic religion of American patriotism.
True. Right. Yeah.
They have that they do consider their constitution and their nation state. Well, yeah. I mean, but they do consider, like, the Constitution of the United States is divine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, even if they won't say overtly like that, it is necessarily important. And it is very, you know, it is has a spiritual significance. And the Republic.
And that's why people won't, they're very hostile to the idea of amending it anymore.
Yeah, they're done. They're done, yeah. Lincoln did it.
They're like, nope.
Yeah.
We did it. Yeah. It's finished.
Yeah, Lincoln needs another put a amendment? Seal. Like the Prophet Muhammad, you know, Lincoln put a seal on the... upon him. Yeah, so it's all locked up. Lincoln was the last ascended presidential master, the last of that of his school, and no more can you amend the U.S. I mean, because the amending formula
I guess if you can find another airbender, then
one in every 10,000 presidents will be be able to master all three branches.
I am the president. And I am the chair of the majority. And yeah. I am the Supreme Court Justice.
I can do all three types of magics. Yeah. Plus, it doesn't matter because the whole U.S. like state power edifice says, you know, power wins. Everyone else gets
no
banned.
More amendments. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't matter. Like, the rules actually don't matter because it's just like if the president wants something, they basically get it. Yeah. But QAnon has... Like, when you view the U.S. state as having a civic religion component, and that people do spiritually revere their state, then you do see QAnon as a... QAnon makes a lot more sense because it's then a derivation of the existing civic religion, right? And it's less weird when you think about it that way. And they just have a non-canonical text, which is the supposedly revealed leaks, right? That Q is a secret prophet who has been, you know, and depending on, I mean, the explanations are not metaphysical or spiritual in any way, but I think the way it functions is that way. And it can function that way because there's a precedent of this being, again, of there being revealed texts that people accept as revealed. Like, if you buy that premise, then theoretically, people can add new revealed texts, and then that has the same importance. And that's what's happened with QAnon. And I think like that, and so this notion that you can and it makes it really tough to beat, I think.
Well, yes, because every time you disprove any part of it, you're also just proving a part of it, right? Like,
and you can't.
People's slippery beliefs will just sort of like rationalize the new information and recontextualize it, and they're fine.
I mean, to me, the whole thing is like, what? I mean, go back to 2016 election. Trump says America's broken. America, you know, let's make America great again. Hillary Clinton turns around on to media and says at one event, she says, I think America's great already. and that will always lose. Right. that will lose, like, theologically, like, that is just a much less compelling position. Everything's fine. Nothing is wrong. Everything you feel is your own fault. Versus, yes. I need you, Joe Jet Ski dealership owner, to rise up and purge the nation of the pedophiles. And there's no problem with racist cops. The only problem is that there are wealthy people, Jews, but that's a coincidence. We're not right. That there's this.
The wild thing about it to me is that he's like, there's a systemic issue here. All of the problems that are facing you right now come from the system of governance that we have in place, the swamp, and it's controlled by some shadowy forces. And if we can just upend this system, we can solve the problem. And you're like, you're so close. You are so close. God damn it. Right?
Yeah, I mean, and then QAnon is really like, and this is part of why, like, it's kind of crazy to think of QAnon as being like actually really dangerous, because one of the things embedded in QAnon is the belief that all this is happening in this is a secret spiritual war that's based on your personal convictions and how you conduct yourself online, and it does not require you, because the secret war happening in the background of photos is ongoing regardless of what actually happens. So, right. And this is where, like, I think people who like advance theory that like it has like that maybe there are some like internal national security origins to QAnon, which, you know, I don't really have a lot of evidence for, but I'm sympathetic to that reading, because it tells people have the revolution online by bullying Antifa, by bullying, by yelling, by organizing and drowning out the signal and delegitimizing people with legitimate grievances.
Yeah.
Which is what QAnon does.
Like, these conspiracy theories, this is nothing new.
No.
Like, this has been going on for a long time. I don't know a lot about it, but the book The Two Babylons was written in, like, the early 19th century, and it talks about how the Roman Catholic Church is actually the Babylonian church that's referenced in the Bible. And so, in fact, the Pope is the Antichrist, and Roman Catholics are all actual devil worshippers.
Amateur eschatology.
And... yeah, and so it's like, it's looking through the Book of Revelations, and it writes all of this wild stuff, and it gets adopted pretty widespread, and preachers are using it to, like, preach against Roman Catholics, and it's just like, it's lies made up whole cloth. But it's like the Jehovah's Witnesses adopted it and had it in things like the Watchtower until the 80s. Jack Chick of Chick Tracks endorsed the book, and you can buy it on his store, like in his store. It's still available to this day.
It's still available on the Jack. I mean, Jack Chick's dead.
The great Christian
propagandist, evangelical, far right propagandist, yeah. Jack Chick, yeah.
And it's like this thing that was written 200 years ago is still influencing this conspiracy of, like, all Roman Catholics are actual devil baby eating. And you're like, okay, wild.
And this happens once in a while. These texts come along, like, similarly with anti-Semitism and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Right, which is
right,
like,
yeah,
which is like,
like, that thing's not going to go away.
Cockamine tract, yeah, but it, like, yeah, but yeah. I was in a graveyard.
Crop up year after year after year, yeah. And it may go away for a while, but then somebody will find it and they'll use it to justify a murder of a whole bunch of people. And yeah, it's just like, goddamn.
Yeah. And this thing, I think this is like, we consider ourselves to be beings governed by rationality and logic. And we're not.
We are right. Not.
We are not. We're not. That's not our default setting. Our default setting is we like thing. Get more thing. And right. And so as long as something is presented to you in the right light or in the right way, you will receive it. Right. And the more you like it, the more you're willing to deal with the fact that it is incongruent with many other things around you. I wanted to bring back the Parks and Rec thing because I think that's really interesting. So yeah, so in sure. Parks and Rec, there's this thing about the reasonableists, also known as Zorpies, who are like follow this like who was this UFO cult, and I think this is really interesting because so in UFO lore, one of the main prominent figures, guy wrote an early book about this, is a guy called William Dudley Pelley, and he's a big UFO luminary and theosophist. Luminary from the US. But before all that, he was the leader of the Silver Legion USA, which was a large fascist party in the United States that wanted to purge the country of Jews and Catholics. And ultimately, Pelley, during his UFO days, settled in Indiana and actually left behind quite a legacy. So I do believe that there is a distinct possibility. I don't know how in touch with Indiana politics or, you know, the writers of that show were, but yeah, but I think if you were, you know, like, I think there is a thing that like there is a real through line there from fascism to, you know, to new age spirituality and UFOs into to right wing politics. And to the point now you've seen it go for full circle and now it's pouring out back into overt fascism. And that's, again, what you see in Cuban.
No one's written about it, but I suspect that you're right. You should get in touch with the writers of the show and be like, is this a thing?
I should. I'll email Greg Daniels and pray he doesn't look up the show and find a website about him on the Space Force episode.
Yeah. Hi, Greg. Real big fan. Don't listen to Space Farce. Any other episode?
Okay, we've been at this too long. We got to get moving on to profit mode.
We're done.
Yeah, which is again another theological episode. It's really about what constitutes as a sacred text, who's entitled to interpret it. It's fundamentally about popular hermeneutics versus clerical hermeneutics in a religion in a time of crisis and change. So, profit motive, again, February 20th, 1995. Stem bolts are back, baby! You remember those self-sealing stem bolts from Season 1, Episode 15, Progress? No? Well, to refresh your memory, Nog and Jake came into possession of 1,000 wrappages of Yamak sauce, which they traded to a Lisepian trader for 100 gross of self-sealing stem bolts. So, exciting, and in the end, Quark takes them off of the boys' hands, and they somehow get some land on Bayshore. It doesn't matter. But Quark is finally about to unload them. So he's found some young, foolish woman, and true to form, in addition to price gouging her, Quark is also getting umaks from her. So just as Quark is about to seal the deal, in perhaps more ways than one, Grand Nagus Zek arrives and interrupts Quark, demanding use of Quark's quarters while he is doing business on the station. Quark and Rom become roomies. It's really funny. Quark is revolted by the way Rom keeps his house. He also finds out that Rom has been stealing from him. Things are tense. But then the Nagus presents. He comes out of Quark's room. He's like, I've done it, boys. Here's what I've been working on. He presents the revised rules of acquisition for the modern Ferengi. And so they, you know, they got a book and the Nagus gives it to them. And Quark finds out the Nagus has given away all of his possessions, which, you know, Quark thinks that's a little weird. He's kind of upset about it, but he wants to be on board with Negazek's plan. So sadly, we don't get to read all of the revised rules, but here we got some gems. So rule number one is, if they want their money back, give it to them. and this, of course, is in contrast to rule number one that we all know and love. Once you have their money, never give it back. Rule number 10, greed is dead, in contrast to greed is eternal. 21, never place profit before friendship. Again, contrasting to the opposite, never place friendship above profit. And 22, Latinum tarnishes, but family is forever. This replacing the very weird, a wise man can hear profit in the wind. No loss there. So yes, and we also have 23 and 285. 23 being money can never replace dignity, in contrast with nothing is more important than your health, except for your money. And 285, a good deed is its own reward, versus no good deed ever goes unpunished. Which is my favorite rule of acquisition, so I'm sad they changed it. Needless to say...
Just a quick thing. There is a rule, 102, that nature decays, but Latinum lasts forever.
Right. So really, really...
And I'm very surprised that they didn't tie those two together.
Yeah, yeah, because it is weird to put it on 22. The altruistic tone of these rules inevitably puts the Nagus, and by extension, Quark and Rom, in danger of being thrown from the Tower of Commerce on Ferenginar. Now, Quark trusts the Nagus, and he powers through his revulsion and distaste, assuming it's all part of the, Zek's multidimensional chess and is some brilliant feint to gouge the universe in new and exciting ways. Yeah. But as time goes on, Quark begins to think something is wrong. The Nagus has given up his beloved Hyperion beetle snuff, a favorite vice of his, and the straw that breaks Quark's back is when he learns that Nagus, who has come into possession of the sacred Bajoran Orb of Wisdom from Cardassia 3, and that Zek is just going to repatriate it to Bajor for free. Quark and Rom cannot
Horror
let this
of
stand.
Horrors.
Yeah. That this country would have its that this planet would have its sacred artifact returned to it after it was looted. But Quark and Rom kidnap the Nagus and take him and the orb into the wormhole. There, Quark parlays with the prophets to restore the Nagus's greed. Quark learns that the Nagus became afflicted with altruism when he attempted to use the orb in the wormhole, thinking it would allow him to see the future and thus maximize his profits. The prophets are like, you physical forms, whatever, whatever. They're effusive and inane. But the prophets do accede to Quark's request, and when they return to the station, the Nagus is back to his old self, greedily snorting up beetle snuff and price gouging the Bajorans for the orb. So the episode has a B-plot as well. Of course, Bashir, which I typed here as batshit, which is really funny, is being considered for the prestigious Carrington Award. For his work in the very jargon-filled field of biomolecular replication. Bashir is very in his head about this, because he super wants it, but modesty demands that he,
He's very, very British about it.
Yeah, he's very British about it, yeah, which is funny. And, he doesn't get excited about it. And he admits, he's a long shot to win, right? The Carrington is, a lifetime achievement award. It's given to people who have been around for decades and decades. So everyone on the station gives him a super hard time about it. And in the end, he loses. And instead of the favored establishment doctor getting, it's a dark horse candidate out of nowhere. Henri something. Anyway.
Roger.
Henri Roger, yes. I just wanted to sell me a chocolate for some reason. But... But I guess this trivia we learned from Memory Alpha, I guess this is an inside joke about the 1994 Emmys, in which TNG was a long shot, with NYPD Blue being the favorite. But it turns out a third dark horse show won. White Picket Fences, I want to say. Anyway, it's really not that interesting.
Not even a show I've heard of. Yeah.
Now, back to pretend Bibles. All right.
Talk about something people care about.
Yeah, finally. Something real. Imaginary holy books.
Oh, my God.
I think one of the things that jumps out at me immediately is this notion of then charity in religion. And this is interesting because I think there is this whole issue of those that are properly religious and self-effacing, practice charity. They make basic, that a religious institution should make some basic provision for the most horrific poverty. you know, which is, and there, and that fundamentally that's good. And in a lot of instances, that's what justifies their existence, which is, you know, I think very interesting in the place we're at, where like we have kind of this debate, at least where we live in Alberta, there's a debate. So should the government pass laws to eliminate various social ills, or should we instead have this ongoing, like, civil society movement where people get up, people feel moved by a particular plight and intercede to stop, like, the very worst shit happening out of the goodness of their hearts, because they just can't stand to see it happen. It's a, what do you do? What do you, I might be biased on the subject, but it's a debate happening in a lot of places, I guess. And it is this question of, like, yeah, what is charity? What is a truly charitable person do? And is there something better than charity?
There is. A free and unregulated market.
Which will allow for new levels of greater charity, because when you're super rich, you can give a lot to charity.
No, it allows wealth to trickle down.
All right. We all get rich together.
A rising tide floats all boats. That's a more accurate. Wealthy people don't actually use trickle down economics, trickle down as a justification, because trickle down is a pejorative. It's been a pejorative since it ever came out.
Yeah.
And then we started believing that wealthy people use that as a justification. Nobody ever does. They say things like a rising tide floats all boats, which is just as bullshit, but sounds nicer.
Yeah. The important thing, I think in general, if someone's giving you like a hydrodynamic explanation for how money works, you run.
So there's these trays.
Varying, and some are deep and short or narrow, but others are shallow and wide. God, that video. Anyway. Marshall and I are talking about a very opaque YouTube video that tries to explain Japan's debt crisis. Or not crisis, depending on how you look at it. With just,
I think this is the third or fourth time we've referenced it in a very oblique way. It's amazing.
A hydrodynamic metaphor involving trays.
I really enjoyed in this episode when Quark is back. Well, not back. When Quark goes into the wormhole and brings Zek back with him. And then he has his second orb experience and meets the prophets. And he gives his Gordon Gekko, like, greed is good speech. Mm-hmm. And the prophets all go, no.
That's real dumb.
and he goes, you're right. But here's the thing. You'll be real annoyed if anybody else has to come here and do the same thing that I'm doing now. And it's going to happen. Like, for sure, my brother's going to do it. And probably, like, one of Zach's friends is going to come and do it. Like, somebody else is going to be here, and it's going to be annoying for you. So, like, do yourselves a favor and just put him back to normal, and we'll leave you the fuck alone. And they're like, okay, that is a good, you know, rational self-interest. That's what will get the prophet's attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a verse in the Old Testament about, like, someone going to, like, a judge. And they just, like, the judge is really corrupt and doesn't give a shit. But this woman just harasses him enough. And he's fine. He's like, fine. I'll give you what you want. Leave me alone. It's a good story because I can't tell you any other detail about it. So, good podcasting.
That turns out that doesn't work well in real life.
Not with actual judges.
No. The Canadian Center for Justice of Freedom or whatever.
For constitutional freedom. The Justice Center Constitutional Freedom. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. He hired a private detective to follow a judge around. And now he lost his job. So highly recommend you leave judges alone. We protect them for some reason. We prefer people not harass them.
I will say that an Old Testament judge in 9th century Judea might have had a different job description.
Completely perfectly analogous to a judge in the modern day.
They even wore a wig. Crazy.
Oh, God. Even the lady judge? Did she wear a wig too?
Lady judges. No, I don't think they wore wigs.
There was only one lady judge. I can't remember her name.
Deborah? Ruth, or
maybe Deborah.
Deborah the prophetess?
Yeah, she might have been a judge as well.
Yeah. And then who's the left-handed judge? He like fell on and like he was really fat and something like, and he like sucked a sword up into his body. It's super fucking gross.
You're right. Deborah is her name. And yeah. She's the only female judge mentioned in the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's the left-handed judge, Ehud, from the tribe of Benjamin.
This is Old Testament Bible stories.
Yeah. I only do this because
our new segment.
They were talking about Adventures
every,
in Radiology.
Every episode, we're going to bring up a ridiculous. That's where I learned about the Deborah being the only lady judge.
Yeah, yeah.
Adventures in Ideology. You will learn a new fact.
Yeah. You want to learn about? You want to learn some Bible stuff? But back to again, pretend Bibles. I feel like this is it's very interesting. Like, but again, you know, you have this thing where, again, altruism is not compelling. It wasn't theologically compelling. Because again, it was asking the Ferengi to give up, to relax the struggle, which is interesting. Because I think if you delve down really deep into the core of a lot of religions, a lot of what they're asking people to do is give up, like let go, release the struggle and the agony you're putting yourself through, which. Fundamentally, our psychology is very antithetical to. So then religions to survive have to find some way to, you know, they synthesize, right? And that's what makes religion one of the most interesting, incredible, and in some instances really worthwhile things to think about and look at. The night is dark and full of perils or whatever.
Terror, but yes.
Yeah, sure. You can fuck yourself psychologically with this stuff if you're not careful.
Yeah. You're not alone, my friend. It's interesting because the prophets say, in the past, Ferengis were not as profit driven as they are now, which makes a lot of sense because
how can you evolve? Like,
well, and there's not a gene for being greedy, right? It's not like, oh, all Ferengis have the greed gene. It's like it's a socialized thing, right?
It's a social construct. Yeah.
And the idea of success being running a slug cola business. Well, okay, now you're successful. That's something that is built and is taught. You don't come out of the womb with an innate desire to run a successful large multinational corporation.
Well, and what it takes to make money and what it takes to produce goods, very different skill sets. Right?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Right? Which is why you can have these like rise and grind, these very brilliant people who are like, they'll talk your ear off and they'll sell you on something amazing, but at the end of the day, they can't actually do anything.
No.
Elon Musk has never and probably will never deliver on many of his grand pronouncements, but he's very good at making a ton of money and maybe eventually giving you something that kind of looks like it, right? He's not, and I think this is the problem with the Ferengi. How have they functioned as a society if all
well,
they do
like
is
we
venerate
know that they
grifters.
Purchased somehow, they purchased warp drives from somebody. Which doesn't make a lot of I don't know who would sell that to them. Whoever sold it to them,
someone greedy
got had. No, if you were greedy, you would never sell that warp drive technology.
Someone cash strapped,
right? Because you can. Well, I guess if it was like I could sell it now for a lot of money instead of like a constant revenue stream forever. Because if the Ferengi could never leave their planet. You have a source of trade forever. you can bring them the rare and curious goods from all over the galaxy that they have no other source.
And you get to set the price.
Yeah. As long as they demand, as long as there's any demand for it, you can be like,
how much for the wind up chattering plastic teeth from Earth? $10 billion. They're very expensive. I had to travel to a special place called Spencer's Gifts, a high-end boutique on Earth.
I had to go to San Francisco. Yeah, anyway, so the Ferengi, like, they purchased the warp drive from someone else. And they said, like, that's basically how they've made all of their technological process, is purchasing technology from others. There aren't really Ferengi engineers and Ferengi scientists, right? Which is bizarre, because there are Ferengi laborers.
It's a 40K situation. like Warhammer. they just have like some robots that make things, and they're just like, I hope I don't lose this. You know, they don't understand it, but they can turn it on or whatever.
Yeah. But like, it's weird that there's Ferengi who are wait staff, but not Ferengi who are computer engineers.
Well, I mean, Rom kind of is not a computer engineer. Yeah. But...
And then everybody, well, he is also an engineer in Star Trek, is an everything engineer. They had specialized and then they generalized. And...
Well, I think this, yeah, I mean, the one thing that the writers of Star Trek are extremely deaf to is the difference between the profession of engineering and the engineering trades. And so often when you have like ship engineers, those are people in an engineering trade, although they might be trained as engineers or even a professional engineer, but they're in the, you know, you have like the power engineering trade, the engine engineering trade, like, because in the past engineering was actually like something like, you know, like welding or like carpentry, right? It was something you apprenticed at. It wasn't a university program. And so it's confusing to the uninitiated, I guess. And I guess, yeah. So they routinely confuse this in the show.
Engineers love that people confuse this.
Because it gives them a chance to talk about engineering.
Well, no, engineers like with a pinky ring love the idea that everyone thinks that they can solve any problem.
Yes.
Right? But you're like, well, no, you can just do ridiculously weird parabolic math. Like, it's fine. You're basically an economist of science.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe the Ferengi are the greatest engineers. Because they're all
That's applied. Probably true.
They don't do primary scientific research. So we shouldn't say,
yeah. You know, the charity work that they're doing is also interesting.
Yeah, because they start the Ferengi Benevolent Association, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is my favorite part. I can't believe I forgot to mention this.
And Rom gets to run it, which is, you know, fine, I suppose. And I guess he takes all the waiters from the bar to do it, or he imports Ferengi from somewhere. And so there's just like a room full of Ferengi running around.
Arranging grain shipments
stuff away.
To famine-afflicted areas.
Yeah. My favorite part is that Quark comes into the room and he's like, what the hell's going on here? And Rom is like, it's the Benevolent Association. We're helping people. And then he gets angry and he's like, oh, God. And some random Ferengi walks up and like asks Quark a question about something on a data pad that he's not seen before, he's not involved in, and has no knowledge of. Why did you have that part in here?
It's to create a kinetic feeling. Yes. That things are happening and there's business. But the ultimate resolution of this episode is Quark is left, like, he's worked very hard to restore order to Ferengi society and avoid a major catastrophe. And he's like, well, it would have been nice if I'd made some money, because, you know, Zach's not going to pay me for this. And then Rom's like, well, I was in charge of the Benevolent Society, and I did embezzle significant amounts
a lot of
money.
I embezzled enough that we can share.
Which was quite lovely. Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
Not I mean, embezzling is bad. It's a felony and it's deeply unethical. But
depends on from whom you're embezzling. You know? I'm going to withhold judgment on embezzling as a whole.
I will say in this case, Rom's embezzling was probably bad.
Yes.
Yeah. Because that was literally taking apples out of the mouths of orphans.
Yes. And yeah. Blankets.
And blankets. Damn it. Sure, you got to make those payments or they'll come around and take
I'm not even sure if the Benevolent Association had enough money to afford blankets. Like with
blankets being notoriously expensive in Star Trek. Have you ever seen one? Neither have I. You go on their beds, there's no...
Super thin, tiny blankets. You know, like, duvets just went right out. It's because that thistle's so hard to find.
Callback. Good, I like it. Okay, so I'm basically out. I think I could rattle around for something, but...
The only other thing that I'm going to say about this episode is that it's sort of the inspiration for the name of our show.
Yes. It makes the opposite joke that we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo! There you go.
French chef kiss.
Yeah. But, you know, I didn't hate it. I didn't hate either episode. I think they're both decent episodes. They're really getting into the nice stride. They've got good ensembles. You know, you start to see the relationship really between Bashir and Miles. In this episode with the Carrington.
Yeah, because.
Like at one point they're playing darts and it's the first time that they play darts. Like they just set up the dartboard in some random cargo bay or something. And Bashir's like, are you sure? And Miles is like, yeah, well, you know, it's better than playing another round of tennis. And he's like, fair enough. And then Miles is ribbing Julian about the Carrington and it's throwing Julian off his game. And then Julian, in turn, gives Miles a hard time about Keiko being still exploring the unknown parts of Bajor. And it throws Miles off his game. And you're like, oh, yeah, they're friends. They're friendly people. They get, you know, it's really building into this thing. Relationships are solidifying and how
characters are developing.
They have arcs throughout the rest of the show or everything, but like you really, this is sort of crystallizing how they're going to perform for the next four seasons. Right. Yeah. So
writing and acting are happening.
Yes, exactly. So they were nice. I liked them. I watched them again and I was like, oh yeah, these are not bad episodes.
If you want to listen to more of our show, you can find us on our website, androidsandassets.ca. Or, alternatively, you can find us on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, by finding @AssetDroid. Alternatively, if you're still on Facebook, you can find us on Facebook at Androids and Assets. And if you want to send us an old-fashioned email, you can email info@androidsandassets.ca. So next time you are sitting at the precipice of dramatic social and or environmental change, and you are trying to find a way to revise the texts and or add parallel text to your religion that would radically redefine the way we understand the world around us and each other, please listen to our podcast. It might give you some ideas for your heretical branch religion.